This is the Internet Multicasting Service. Harper Audio presents selections from the ecologically prophetic Dune Trilogy, read by the author, Frank Herbert.
Jameis stepped into the ring, slipped out of his robe, and tossed it to someone in the crowd. He stood there in a cloudy gray slickness of stillsuit that was patched and marked by tucks and gathers. For a moment he bent with his mouth to his shoulder, drinking from a catch-pocket tube. Presently he straightened, peeled off, and detached the suit, handed it carefully into the crowd. He stood waiting, clad in loincloth and some tight fabric over his feet, a kris-knife in his right hand. Jessica saw the girl child, Chaney, helping Paul, saw her press a kris-knife handle into his palm, saw him heft it, testing the weight and balance. And it came to Jessica that Paul had been trained in prana and bindu, the nerve and the fiber, that he had been taught fighting in a deadly school, his teachers men like Duncan Idaho and Gurney Halleck, men who were legends in their own lifetimes. The boy knew the devious ways of the Bene Gesserit, and he looked supple and confident. But he's only 15, she thought, and he has no shield. I must stop this. Somehow there must be a way to... She looked up, saw Stilgar watching her. You cannot stop it, he said. You must not speak. She put a hand over her mouth, thinking, I've planted fear in Jameis's mind. I'll slow him some. Perhaps... If I could only pray, truly pray... Paul stood alone now, just into the ring, clad in the fighting trunks he'd worn under his stillsuit. He held a kris-knife in his right hand. His feet were bare against the sand-gritted rock. Idaho had warned him time and again... When in doubt of your surface, bare feet are best. And there were Cheney's words of instruction still in the front of his consciousness. Jameis turns to the right with his knife after a parry. It's a habit in him we've all seen, and he'll aim for the eyes to catch a blink in which to slash you, and he can fight either hand. Look out for a knife shift. But strongest in Paul, so that he felt it with his entire body, was training and the instinctual reaction mechanism that had been hammered into him day after day, hour after hour, on the practice floor. Gurney Halleck's words were there to remember. The good knife fighter thinks on point and blade and shearing guard simultaneously. The point can also cut, the blade can also stab, the shearing guard can also trap your opponent's blade. Paul glanced at the kris-knife. There was no shearing guard, only the slim, round ring of the handle, with its raised lips to protect the hand. And even so, he realized that he did not know the breaking tension of this blade, did not even know if it could be broken. Jameis began sidling to the right along the edge of the ring opposite Paul. Paul crouched, realizing then that he had no shield, but was trained to fighting with its subtle field around him, trained to react on defense with utmost speed, while his attack would be timed to the controlled slowness necessary for penetrating the enemy's shield. In spite of constant warning from his trainers not to depend on the shield's mindless blunting of attack speed, he knew that shield awareness was part of him. Jameis called out in ritual challenge, May thy knife chip and shatter! This knife will break then, Paul thought. He cautioned himself that Jameis also was without shield, but the man wasn't trained to its use, had no shield fighter inhibitions. Paul stared across the ring at Jameis. The man's body looked like knotted whipcord on a dried skeleton. His kris-knife shone milky yellow in the light of the glow-globes. Fear coursed through Paul. He felt suddenly alone and naked, standing in dull yellow light within this ring of people. Prescience had fed his knowledge with countless experiences, hinted at the strongest currents of the future and the strings of decision that guided them, but this was the real now. This was death, hanging on an infinite number of minuscule mischances. Anything could tip the future here, he realized. Someone coughing in the troop of watchers, a distraction, a variation in a glow-globe's brilliance, a deceptive shadow. I'm afraid, Paul told himself, and he circled warily opposite Jameis, repeating silently to himself the Bene Gesserit litany against fear. Fear is the mind-killer. It was a cool bath washing over him. He felt muscles untie themselves, become poised and ready. I'll sheathe my knife in your blood, Jameis snarled, and in the middle of the last word he pounced. Jessica saw the motion, stifled an outcry. Where the man struck, there was only empty air, and Paul stood now behind Jameis with a clear shot at the exposed back. "Now, Paul, now!" Jessica screamed it in her mind. Paul's motion was slowly timed, beautifully fluid, but so slow it gave Jameis the margin to twist away, backing and turning to the right. Paul withdrew, crouching low. "First you must find my blood," he said. Jessica recognized the shield fighter timing in her son, and it came over her what a two-edged thing that was. The boy's reactions were those of youth and trained to a peak these people had never seen. But the attack was trained, too, and conditioned by the necessities of penetrating a shield barrier. A shield would repel too fast a blow, admit only the slowly deceptive counter. It needed control and trickery to get through a shield. "Does Paul see it?" she asked herself. "He must." Again Jameis attacked, ink-dark eyes glaring, his body a yellow blur against the glow-globes, and again Paul slipped away to return too slowly on the attack, and again, each time Paul's counter-blow came an instant late, and Jessica saw a thing she hoped Jameis did not see. Paul's defensive reactions were blindingly fast, but they moved each time at the precisely correct angle they would take if a shield were helping deflect part of Jameis's blow. "Is your son playing with that poor fool?" Stilgar asked. He waved her to silence before she could respond. "Sorry, you must remain silent." Now the two figures on the rock floor circled each other, Jameis with knife hand held far forward and tipped up slightly. Paul crouched with knife held low. Again Jameis pounced, and this time he twisted to the right where Paul had been dodging. Instead of faking back and out, Paul met the man's knife hand on the point of his own blade. Then the boy was gone, twisting away to the left and thankful for Cheney's warning. Jameis backed into the center of the circle, rubbing his knife hand. Blood dripped from the injury for a moment, stopped. His eyes were wide and staring, two blue-black holes, studying Paul with a new wariness in the dull light of the glow-globes. "Ah, that one hurt," Stilgar murmured. Paul crouched at the ready, and as he had been trained to do after first blood, called out, "Do you yield?" "Ha!" Jameis cried. An angry murmur arose from the troop. "Hold!" Stilgar called out. "The lad doesn't know our rule." Then to Paul, "There can be no yielding in the Tahadi challenge. Death is the test of it." Jessica saw Paul swallow hard, and she thought, "He's never killed a man like this, in the hot blood of a knife fight. Can he do it?" Paul circled slowly right, forced by Jameis's movement. The prescient knowledge of the time-boiling variables in this cave came back to plague him now. His new understanding told him there were too many swiftly compressed decisions in this fight for any clear channel ahead to show itself. Variable piled on variable. That was why this cave lay as a blurred nexus in his path. It was like a gigantic rock in the flood, creating maelstroms in the current around it. "Have an end to it, lad," Stilgar muttered. "Don't play with him." Paul crept farther into the ring, relying on his own edge and speed. Jameis backed, now that the realization swept over him that this was no soft outworlder in the Tahadi ring, easy prey for a Fremen Chrisknife. Jessica saw the shadow of desperation in the man's face. "Now is when he's most dangerous," she thought. "Now he's desperate and can do anything. He sees that this is not like a child of his own people, but a fighting machine born and trained to it from infancy. Now the fear I planted in him has come to bloom." And she found in herself a sense of pity for Jameis, an emotion tempered by awareness of the immediate peril to her son. Jameis could do anything, any unpredictable thing, she told herself. She wondered then if Paul had glimpsed this future, if he were reliving this experience. Paul pressed the fight now, circling but not attacking. He had seen the fear in his opponent. Memory of Duncan Idaho's voice flowed through Paul's awareness. "When your opponent fears you, then's the moment when you give the fear its own rein. Give it the time to work on him. Let it become terror. The terrified man fights himself. Eventually he attacks in desperation. That is the most dangerous moment, but the terrified man can be trusted usually to make a fatal mistake. You are being trained here to detect these mistakes and use them."
This has been Harper Audio. HarperCollins is the copyright owner of this recording and has consented to a limited distribution of Harper Audio as an 8 kHz computer sound file on Internet Town Hall. It is a violation of United States and international copyright laws to copy these recordings in any other way. Harper Audio is a trademark of HarperCollins Publishers, Inc. To order a copy of this tape or to request a catalog of all Harper Audio spoken word cassettes, please call 1-800-C-HARPER or 717-941-1214 or send mail to harper@town.hall.org. This has been a production of the Internet Multicasting Service. Support for Harper Audio is provided by HarperCollins and by Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Network connectivity for the Internet Multicasting Service is provided by UUNET Technologies and MFS DataNet.